From WHQR in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. One in five women will be raped at some point in their lives. One in 71 men will face that same level of sexual violence. That's according to the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. For women of multiracial backgrounds, the risk of assault is higher, 45%. High rates of sexual violence and continued high-profile harassment and assault cases highlight the need for taking a closer look at the root causes. Some experts contend one of those is an unhealthy cultural view about what it means to be a man. Ricky Houston spends his life talking about this issue and teaching new ways of thinking about and being a man to professional athletes in the NFL, NBA, NHL, and MLB. It's part of his work as the lead trainer for A Call to Men, the Next Generation of Manhood, a national nonprofit that also leads trainings on university campuses for military and for corporations. Ricky Houston is a prevention specialist for the Wilmington Domestic Violence Shelter and Services, and he's a reverend at Pilgrim Rest Missionary Baptist Church. He joins us now. Ricky Houston, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. And just a reminder, today's program is pre-recorded. Ricky Houston, what is it about the way men are raised that you think contributes to violence against women?
We look at what society has taught us, what it means to be a man. And there's no written rules. There's no book about what it means to be a man. But it's those things that men are in charge, that we have to be in control, that we don't show emotions. Except one emotion, we're allowed to show anger. And what we realize is that anger is not a primary emotion. It's a secondary emotion. And it normally comes from a hurt or pain. But I'm not allowed to say that you hurt my feelings. But we're taught to show aggression or to show anger. That's accepted.
And how does the repression of emotions in men connect with violence against women?
When we look at how we handle different situations, when we suppress our emotions, we don't talk about what's really happening. And what has been passed down, whether it's been through what we've seen in relationships or either what we've seen growing up from our fathers or from other men within our community, even what we see sometimes in movies and lyrics and songs of how we treat women, just the violence has been is that now we pass that along because what it is, we're taught as men that we're supposed to be dominant, that we're supposed to be in control, and we pass that anger along. And another thing is, too, is that we even with other men, is that we show that aggression toward other men. We can't have really conversations. And with holding that that pain in or that emotions in, you know, it really causes, you know, a health impact because when we suppress our emotions, and sometimes in training I tell other men is that's why women live longer than we do because women will talk about things, but as men we'll have different issues, but we're taught that, you know, we don't share that. We don't talk about that. And we're taught that at a very early age about showing emotions. Most men I talk to is that one of the things we always talk, I begin to share a story. And I say, and big boys what? And everyone says, don't cry. So at a very early age, we're taught to mask those emotions.
You recently trained the Carolina Panthers. And just hearing you talk about some of the ways that men are trained to repress their emotions and to be in control and to consider themselves the dominant person in every situation. And that's really what being a man is. I can imagine there's some resistance when you walk into a room with professional football players. What is that like, and how do you open that conversation with them?
The main thing is that what you just said, a conversation. When I walk in a room is that, especially a call to men, we're not here to indict men, but to have a conversation with men. And when we begin to talk about the collective socialization around manhood, there are things that men want to talk about. They want to have this conversation. Because when we talk about that, what I said earlier about the unwritten rules around manhood, that we always have to be tough, we always have to be in control, we always have to be the best one on the field, we can't always live up to that. And so when we talk about those unwritten rules, then we begin to have these conversations. There are times that we feel pain. There are times that we need to talk with someone. And the next thing, too, is that in having these conversations, what I realize is and what I've come to understand is that when I walk in those rooms, when the stats that you gave earlier about 1 in 5 sexual assault, 1 in 4 domestic violence. So when I walk in that room, I realize is the men that I'm talking to, they're ones who have been affected by the violence. And what I mean by that is that the person it happens to is affected, but the people who love that person are affected, or they grew up in a home with domestic violence. And so it really kind of opens up some wounds and they're ready to have conversations. Most of the time when I'm speaking, I have a conference or I'm doing a workshop, there's always a few who want to wait around and talk to me afterwards because they're dealing with that pain and they're really open to having this conversation.
So is it often then that you'll go and you'll present and you'll cause these guys to think about some things in a way that perhaps they haven't thought about them before, and then after your talk, someone will come to you and maybe admit to having perpetrated violence against someone?
Normally, I don't have anyone to say, you know, that I perpetrated the violence. Most of the time, what I see is that men talk about, you know, this whole socialization of how I have to live up to, or either I don't necessarily see my role in preventing the violence. And what I mean by that is when we talk about here at Call to Men, one of our co-founders, Tony Porter, made a statement at a conference one time and said if women could have ended the violence, they would have did it a long time ago. It's going to take men holding one another accountable. It's going to take men addressing one another about our actions. And so what we're finding is that as we have these conversations, because our conversation is around prevention. Our message last couple of years in with the NFL has been influence and platform. And what we mean by that is that you're very influential. Not only do kids watch professional sports, but big kids like me with a gray in the beard, you know. And so, you know, when they have a commercial about a car, we buy the car, you know, whatever the commercial is. And so what we're trying to do is get them to use their influence to develop a platform that we begin to have these conversations. And when we talk about having the conversations, I challenge players to go back to their colleges where they play college sports at, you know, have this conversation. I challenge players to go back to their high schools where your jerseys have been retired and hanging in the rafters. You have a platform. Have these conversations. This is how we develop that next generation of manhood. Well, not only manhood, but healthy manhood, where we eradicate violence against women.
So I just want to be clear. You're saying that when you speak to these guys, these professional athletes, you're not necessarily encountering resistance to what you're saying. You're encountering guys who say, this has been a lot of pressure, and I don't want to have to live under this kind of false idea of manhood anymore.
Exactly. It's a lot of undue pressure. And what happens is that we're teaching them. And when we walk in a room, it's not about going in and saying, you guys are the bad guys. What it is that we go in with the conversation is, okay, how do we change this? How do we work together? So as I said earlier, we're not indicting men, but we're inviting men to the conversation, inviting men to use their position, their platforms in order to develop and to really talk about this, you know, give them the tools to have this conversation with other men, not only other men, but other women, because what happens is that when we, you know, when we talk about building a healthy environment, not only are we building a safer place for our daughters, but also for our sons.
You're listening to Coastline. Ricky Houston is our guest today. He's a reverend at Pilgrim Rest Missionary Baptist Church, a prevention specialist for Wilmington Domestic Violence Shelter and Services, and he's the lead trainer for the national organization A Call to Men, the Next Generation of Manhood. Today's edition of Coastline is pre-recorded. The NFL changed its player conduct policies about 4 years ago, driven by some high-profile cases such as Ray Rice, the Baltimore Ravens football player who punched his then-fiancée unconscious, and a lot of people, that story was an international one. Adrian Peterson beat his 4-year-old son with a switch. He still plays professional football. How do you see, understanding that you're training these guys, and so they're allies of yours in this move towards new ideas of manhood, but how do you see the NFL evolving in terms of its policies around that? Is there still too much acceptance of it?
What we've noticed, this is year 5 that we've been the policy has been instituted in the NFL, and plus having the mandatory awareness trainings. And what we've noticed every year that the stats are going down each year. I was talking with someone in legal last Monday, and there have been no investigations this year. So when we look at this and what we've seen with the Ray Rice and what the NFL has done, actually they've really led the way for other sports leagues to develop policies as well. One of the things that I say is that when you look at the numbers in professional sports, they're way lower than they are in general society.
Really?
They're way lower than what they are in general society. But what happens is they're part of the 24-hour news cycle, and they're high profile. So when those things happen, what I would love to happen is that other corporations, other companies, other faith communities begin to, you know, to develop policies, not only develop policies, but begin to have that conversation as well, because I think it starts with a conversation when we bring awareness. One of the things that we found also within faith communities is that when we engage ministers and they begin to preach about it, they realize that it's impacted the congregations as well. So I think the NFL is, and other professional sports leagues are doing a really good job of, number one, developing the policy and really bringing awareness, but also bringing the trainings, but giving the players resources. So if they have these challenges, that they have a place that they can go and receive the help that they need.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with the Reverend Ricky Houston of A Call to Men, the Next Generation of Manhood. When we return from this break, more on reimagining what it means to be masculine and how Ricky Houston teaches that concept to some of the most masculine people in the world. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today we're exploring how hypermasculinity contributes to sexual violence and how one national nonprofit is seeking to teach professional athletes to rethink what it means to be a man and how one local man is leading that charge. Reverend Ricky Houston of Pilgrim Rest Missionary Baptist Church is a prevention specialist for Wilmington Domestic Violence Shelter and Services, and he's the lead trainer for A Call to Men, the Next Generation of Manhood, a national nonprofit that trains athletes in the NFL, NBA, NHL, and MLB, and leads trainings for military on university campuses and at corporations. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. Ricky Houston, you mentioned that sometimes when you're having these conversations with men about how they've been kind of programmed into a false idea of manhood, they may have come from backgrounds in which they witnessed the alpha male perpetrating violence against women. Can a boy who is raised in an atmosphere like that, who sees his mom being beaten or even sexually assaulted by a significant other, can those attitudes change?
Yes, and that's why we do prevention, because what we've learned about especially domestic violence, it's learned behavior. And that that's learned can be unlearned. And so because you know we're taught with what we've seen, there are several cases that I know with professional athletes who talked about growing up in abusive homes, who now have nonprofits, you know, where they engage, you know, the conversation around domestic violence, who really put a lot of work in prevention. Sometimes what we see is that, you know, that young boy becomes that man, becomes that guy. But then there are other times when, you know, that's not who I want to be. That's why it's so important. One of the things that we really, we talked about influence and platform with professional athletes, having this conversation, going back and engaging younger players, going back and engaging young boys around healthy manhood so that they would be that positive person in someone's life, show them a better in a different way.
What is an example of moving from this kind of, you know, culturally imposed idea of hypermasculinity, that being a man, versus what you teach about what it means to be a man. Where are the differences?
Well, one of the things we teach is that especially, you know, when we talk about hypermasculinity, we normally see that with athletes. And one of the things we teach is that it's not always about the athlete and the hypermasculinity, because sometimes we say, you know, those are the tough guys or whatever, but it's about attitudes. It's about changing attitudes, because for the person who's not an athlete, for the person but who grew up in that violent home, or either for some of the preconceived notions that we have around women, one of the things that we look at are called to men, you know, how we've been traditionally to view women as less valiant, to view women as property, or sexual objects, objectification of women. And
I just want to be clear about that, because you're saying that we really are taught in this American culture in 2018 to view men as more valuable than women, to view women as inferior, and to view women as objects and the property of men. I mean, what those words, that language actually sounds like something from 200 years ago, but it's not.
Yeah, and that's the sadness of it, is that, you know, when you hear that, you think about 200 years ago, a very patriarchal society. But there's not, you know, we've come a long way, but there's a lot, there's, you know, still a lot of things that we need to change. When we look at this, there's a story I share sometimes. Sometimes I share the video of during a training of a father who's taking his kid to get his vaccinations. Little boy is maybe 3 years old, and his dad takes him, and the nurse comes out and said, "This may hurt a little bit." And his dad tells him, "You're a big boy, and big boys don't cry." And he has to get 3 shots, and he gets his first one, and the smile goes to a little frown. The second one comes, and his dad reminds him that you're a big boy, and big boys don't cry. And it goes to the second one, tears begin to flow. Third shot, he's vocal now. He's crying, and his dad is reminding him, "You're a big boy, big boys don't cry." And he tells him, "Say I'm a man." At 3 years old, he's telling him to say I'm a man. So he's teaching him to suppress his emotions. But I did not throw a hypothetical in this. Now, what if, now that we've watched the video, what if this little boy would have had a twin sister and she was getting her vaccination? Would she have been allowed to cry? And they were like, yes. Okay, so what are we teaching this little boy about his emotions? That he needs to mask his emotions. But his sister, she can show her emotions. So at that point then we're teaching him at a very early age to not to value the experiences of women and girls. That boys are tough, girls are weak, boys are strong. And then until around teenage years, then all it becomes around sexual conquest, objectification of women. We begin to see them as sexual objects rather than their humanity. So when we tell that little boy at a very young age that you're a big boy, big boys don't cry. For me, I'm very blessed to have, I guess I can't call them kids now, 2 are young adults. But when they were small, what would it look like? My son is the youngest. What would it look like with me traveling to tell my 8-year-old son that you're the man of the house while I'm gone? And so when we look at these messages, what I'm saying is that my wife, who's an adult woman, my daughter, who's 8 years older than my son, that I'm really putting their well-being, their welfare, their care in an 8-year-old boy's hand. So what are the messages that we're sending at that early age?
Do you think that women should share past sexual assaults with family members as a way of continuing to expand the conversation, or is that harmful? I mean, when we think about this conversation in the era of the Me Too movement and how that's kind of blown it open in new and dramatic ways that are still scary for a lot of people, is that one way to keep that conversation open and expanding?
What we have to think about, especially when we talk about sexual assaults and rapes, 80% of victims don't report. And the reason they don't report is the fear of being re-victimized, the fear of not being believed. And we have to think about the number of people who are carrying the shame of what did I do to cause this. Sometimes they begin to blame it on themselves. With another trainer, another young lady who shared her story, for 20 years, did not talk about it. And because she didn't talk about it when it happened to her at 5 years old, then it happened again at 16. So what if she was able to talk about it, you know, at 5, get the resources and the help that she needed, you know, to help really to expedite healing or either start the healing process get the resources you needed. But it happened again. So when we think about it, when people begin to talk about it, it opens up avenues for other people to begin to come forth and share their past pains. Or not only that, for someone that it happens to, that they feel that they can get the help and resource they need.
You know, when we look at the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, that really highlighted the polarization of the nation, politically, certainly. But it also, you know, if you were watching those hearings thinking a very good man is being pilloried and having his reputation torn apart, then it would make you enraged. And if you were watching a privileged white guy get away with sexual assault, then it would make you enraged. And it was interesting to see how people fell on which side of the fence there. But after those hearings ended, there was a poll conducted that found a discrepancy between men and women, where women would be less likely to report sexual assault after the Kavanaugh confirmation. And not as many men think women would be less likely to report. Like, in other words, men aren't as open to the sensitivity of that idea, that it's hard to report. Do you think that we went backwards in some ways after those hearings? Or is that an opportunity?
I think it's an opportunity. You know, we really don't, you know, look at one occasion or one instance. But when we look at historically, it's been a challenge, you know, for women to come forth. I think the Me Too movement really kind of opened up where women were really coming forth and beginning to share those sexual assaults. But not only women, but we saw where men were finally coming forward as well. There was a number that we don't often talk about, is that especially for men between up to 18 years of age, 1 in 7. But then it goes after 18 to 1 in 71. And so there are a lot of men who are carrying past sexual assaults as well. But when we look at women and men, when you think about sometimes I talk about guilt and shame. And when we look at guilt is something that I did. And I can come to you and say, I'm sorry. And that's how I lighten my load. But shame is normally when someone else, you know, perpetrate something against you. And sometimes we carry something that is not ours to carry. No one has to be sexually assaulted. No one has to be raped. No one has to be abused. But for somehow, and sometimes perpetrators have a very good way of making you feel that it's your fault. And that's a reason sometimes people don't report. Or if I was able to do a training for a network, and I just shared with those commentators and producers I talked about, is that it's an opportunity for you to educate your audience why people don't report. For instance, if breaking news happened now and someone was sexually assaulted, the questions that we've been taught to ask in the past are, what time was it? What was she wearing? Has she been drinking? None of those things should matter. Or what should matter is, for the person who perpetrated that violence, what gave them the right and made them feel that they could do that to this person? Those sort of things, especially with domestic violence, is that why do people stay? What are some reasons that people stay in these abusive relationships? It's the opportunity for you to educate your audience. Is that, you know, sometimes, because when we think about, normally when we talk about domestic violence, we only think about physical abuse, and we never think about the psychological and the emotional and the mental abuse that take place. Which is always a component. And so when we have these conversations about, you know, being set back, I think what we have to do is what we're doing right now is continue to have these conversations for people who are victims and really encourage them to come forth in order to get the help that they need. But also, I think as they come forth, it's going to open the doors for victims who maybe currently something has taken place, that they can get the resources they need. But the next thing is to do what we're doing right now is to talk about prevention as well. What can we do to change the mindset? What can we do to change culture that we don't have to worry about someone, or change this place where we don't feel like that we can take advantage of someone?
You're listening to Coastline. Ricky Houston is my guest today. He's the lead trainer for the national organization A Call to Men, the Next Generation of Manhood, which leads trainings for professional athletes, university students, military, and corporations. Today's edition of Coastline is pre-recorded. You talk about prevention, and there are some programs that you have in schools called Shifting Boundaries. Can you tell us Who do you teach that to? What age and what is that about?
Shifting Boundaries for 6th and 7th graders. And we're very fortunate now at Domestic Violence Shelter Services that we partner with some middle schools where we go in and we talk about, you know, what is a boundary. And we can talk about geographical boundaries, but then we talk about physical boundaries, touching someone, or either the words that we use, setting rules, setting boundaries for yourself. But not only setting boundaries for yourself, but respecting others' boundaries as well. And so with this particular curriculum, we're setting the stage for a precursor for dating violence as we begin to get into relationships a little later on.
What's an example of a boundary that you would teach kids at that age to set, a healthy boundary?
Number one is, the first is physical boundaries, not allowing someone to touch you, okay? The second boundary is that setting rules for yourself, the type of language that you use, but the type of language that you allow others to use around you.
If someone crosses, let's use that example of a language boundary, and someone calls me a name, that is not okay, and in my view, that's crossing my boundary. What recourse do I have?
Well, and part of the curriculum is that we have a respecting boundaries agreement, and that we teach them how to fill out. When did it happen? Where did it happen? What was said? Who was there? And so I asked the kids, I said, why is it important for us to write down who was there? And they said, witnesses. And they can give that to their teacher. And then there's another form for the student who crossed that person's boundaries to fill out as well. So we're teaching them at an early age, you know, at that point is that there are going to be repercussions to you crossing those boundaries as well. And so,
what kinds of things will the person who crossed the boundary need to put on that form? What kind of self-inquiry goes on there?
Well, the self-inquiry is what someone feels that you crossed their boundary. What do you think happened that they've made them feel this way? So it gives that person opportunity of self-reflection. And then but it also talks about what could you do differently next time. And so it's more than about you shouldn't do this, but how can we do this better as well?
So then possibly getting that child in touch with his or her emotions as well.
Exactly.
You're listening to Coastline. Ricky Houston is my guest today. He's a reverend at Pilgrim Rest Missionary Baptist Church. He's also a prevention specialist for Wilmington Domestic Violence Shelter and Services, and he's the lead trainer for the national organization A Call to Men, the Next Generation of Manhood, which leads trainings for professional athletes, university students, military, and corporations. You also have a program called Safe Dates, still for kids, but older kids. Tell us about
older that. Older kids. It's around 9th and 10th grade, precursors to teen dating violence. And one of the things we have, we talk about what is abuse, the different types of abuse. Why do people abuse? Why someone stays? But then we talk about red flags in dating relationships. And we have a lot of scenarios about how to spot those red flags and how to maneuver once you found out red flags are there, or either to, we have different scenarios to talk about type of, may not be a physical abuse, but emotional abuse. And we ask the students, is this abusive? Why or why not? And then we do another exercise, stay or leave. And so, we give an opportunity to see different types or sometimes how these relationship progresses. It may start out verbally, then emotionally, you know, before leading to physically. And then sometimes we give them a scenario that's not abusive at all. It may be a disagreement. And I think we have to realize that having a disagreement is not verbal abuse, but verbal abuse is when we intentionally demean, dehumanize, degrade someone. And that's when verbal abuse takes place. So we're beginning to show them the different types of relationship and the different red flags in a dating relationship.
Earlier, you mentioned as part of the cultural issue, and this comes up in Tony Porter's TED Talk, one of the founders of A Call to Men, that we say to a young boy, if he's not performing well on the field, he throws like a girl. And that's such an interesting idea, because that still goes on. That's still very much a part of the vernacular. Why do you think that's a dangerous idea? Shouldn't a boy throw like a boy?
What happens is that it's said to be demeaning. It's said to, when we talk about as I said earlier about treating women with less value, then what happens is big part of that male socialization, when I talked about the little boy with his shots, getting his vaccinations, what we're saying is that boys are strong, girls are weak. And so if we tell him that he's playing like a girl, that's a trigger to get him to run faster, to jump higher, to throw harder. So that's what that trigger is about. So what happens is that at that, you know, he's a little boy. He's playing, you know, he's playing baseball or whatever. But when we tell him he's throwing like a girl, then all of a sudden it's said in a very demeaning way to women, because we want him to really escalate his game. Because that's what all boys know, is that when you're told you're playing like a girl, then, you know, you're saying you're weak. And so we have, and that's one of the next thing too, is that's why it's important for us to work with coaches, with the language that they use when we're coaching boys at a very early age. And one of the curriculums we have, a call to men, is called Live Respect. And that's why we're teaching that respect at a very, very early age. But it's not only good for the players, but it's good for coaches as well, with the language that we're using, that we're passing on. When we look at this whole thing around manhood, this is what's been passed on to generation to generation. Sometimes when I'm with college kids, I walk in and say, I want to apologize to you, because I think I'm the oldest man in the room. That's because what you've learned about manhood, you learned from my generation.
And that's one of the things that I want to get you to unpack when we come back from this next break, is how you teach the idea that women are as valuable as men when we're culturally conditioned to think otherwise. You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation about domestic and sexual violence in the era of the Me Too movement, and how part of that movement involves reshaping the cultural idea of a man. Ricky Houston of A Call to Men is my guest today. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. How do you think about manhood and what that really means? That's part of our exploration today with the Reverend Ricky Houston, who is a prevention specialist for Wilmington Domestic Violence Shelter and Services, and he's the lead trainer for A Call to Men, the Next Generation of Manhood. Today's edition of Coastline is pre-recorded. Just before we went to break, we talked a little bit about teaching men that women are as valuable, despite the fact that men are raised to believe otherwise, as are women. And there's a lot of talk to the contrary. And certainly I know many of our listeners will be thinking, well, I wasn't raised to think women are less valuable. Not at all. Are you kidding? That's something from a generation or two or three or four ago. But it's not. It's subtle. Can you talk about how you teach that to men, and not just raise awareness that that's still there, but how you teach them to value women as equals?
One of the things is that it starts with us as men. It's about what we call the man box, how we've been socialized to act and believe and live and survive as men. Number one, we have to step outside of that box, because what we've done when we created that box, that we have to be in control, we've also created another box for women as well. And so what our goal is to really destroy the man box, because if we destroy the man box, we destroy the box that we have women in as well. When you look at and you think about society, and you, especially if you look at government now, we're seeing more women in Congress. That used to be all men. When we look at corporate America, when we look at CEOs, and when we look at chief executive officers, look at executive directors, mostly in corporations, it's men. But if you look at nonprofits, a lot of your executive directors or CEOs are normally females. So there are things that we're working toward now that we're trying to change, especially when you look at STEM. Used to, in that field, it used to be mostly men getting those degrees. But the thing is that now we're at a place where we're encouraging. As much as we have this conversation with our young boys, as much as I have this conversation with my son, I have to have the same conversation with my daughter and really encourage her and empower her and to be all she can, be her best self.
Did you find, as the father of a daughter that who is now an adult, a thriving adult, did you find that you had to start addressing some of those cultural ideas that were subtle, that she had adopted about her inferiority, her gender inferiority?
I think one of the big things with her is I just really encouraged her to work hard and to be her best self, to choose whatever career path that she wanted to obtain. But it was more work with my son. It was more work with my son. And
what kinds of things did you have to kind of push against with your son?
One of the things with my son was that he was picking up what he was in society. My daughter, when she was in high school, she had a part-time job, and he was afforded the opportunity to go to work with her sometime because it was a place where you could go and entertainment, have fun. But what he noticed, he came in one day and said, "Hey, Dad, it's men's work outside." He was probably 8 years old at this time, and it's women's work in the house. I said, "Well, where do you get that from?" Well, he said, "Well, when we go there, all the boys do this and the girls work behind the snack counter." So what are some of the messages in society that we're sending? So he was seeing things differently at home, even though, hey, I run the washing machine, the dryer, I cook, you know, dishes, my wife and I, we split those, you know, those duties, who's ever home first. But it's not only what he was seeing at home, it was the messages that he was seeing in society as well.
How do you think, so Call to Men was founded in 2001. The Me Too movement has been happening for just a couple of years now. Has this conversation that you're having with A Call to Men, has that changed since the Me Too movement really launched?
No, our message has been the same. When Tony and Ted, Tony Porter, Ted Bunch started this organization, it was really to engage men. And it wasn't engaging men who were abusers, but it was engaging men like myself who were not abusers. But we were benefiting from the unwritten rules around manhood. We were benefiting with treating women with less value. We were benefiting from just really the violence that was taking place. We were not violent, but A Call to Men really came into play because we want to engage those men to see our role about ending men's violence against women, ending the discrimination against women, making sure that women felt valuable, making sure that we were not treating women as sexual objects, making sure that we were not treating women as property.
So let's say you're not a perpetrator of domestic violence or sexual violence or psychological violence of any kind, but you're with a group of men and somebody makes a sexist joke that really is demeaning towards women. So are you the one guy in the room that says, "You really shouldn't talk that way," and then walks out of the room and everybody else laughs at you? I mean, how do you deal with something like that? How do you really become a force for change in a situation like that?
One of the things that I always share, and especially, you know, and I shared again last week with the group that I was with, is that when I have a conversation, I want to have a conversation with you without losing you. And what I mean by that is that when we have a conversation today, I don't want when you see me tomorrow that you're finding a way to walk out the side door before I see you. Is that how can we have this conversation so that you can see yourself? And that's one of the things that are called to men, is that we try to reach out and grab the hearts of men. We try to touch men's heart so that we can, because we just don't want to say that you shouldn't say that. But we want you to see and understand why you shouldn't say.
So then what would you say to me? Let's say I'm that guy and I'm the one that cracked the joke. Then what would you say to me?
It would probably be within the context of how it takes place, and sometimes it may be best to, when you see someone in the room, it may be that I'm not going to talk to this guy in front of everyone. It may be that I'll pull him to the side, because all of a sudden, when we look at this whole man box, when we look at this alpha male, because I engaged him in front of everyone, how I engaged him, where I engaged him, he may respond totally different. Then I pull him to the side and say, "Hey, when we think about that, let's look at this conversation." One of the things that we do to when we're working with college athletes, there are several universities that we go in, and we have multiple sessions with the players. And with one, we give them opportunities where we put lyrics to a song of him. How do you handle this when you hear someone singing this? How do you educate them about the words that they're using? So I think sometimes it's not what we say, but it's how we say it. So if we can educate that person on why we shouldn't do it, rather than, I don't want to be the guy in the room saying, you shouldn't say that, and just walk out and say, oh, that's Rick Houston. But how can I change your mindset? Because when I can begin to teach you why we shouldn't say this, or how it makes someone feel. Because what happens is that there are people in the room who will laugh just to really kind of get along. And sometimes look at the power dynamic in the room. Depends on who says the joke. If you're the person that's in charge, or you're the one that's looked at as the leader of the room, then I want to be accepted. Then I'll laugh, but I really don't agree with it. So how do we have that conversation with the person to say? Actually, I was in an environment a couple of weeks ago, and the person who was over his division, he shared with me, he said, Rick, he said, I shared is that we do not tolerate this, you know, within my area of the workplace. What you do after you leave, I don't control, but here at work, this is the type of environment that we set. So one of the things that we try to do when we talk about building culture is that some culture is something that we can change. And so as a leader, that's why it's so important that we sit down and talk with the leaders so that they can understand the value of not that we're just not doing this, but the reason why we're not doing this. How would it make your wife feel, or your mother feel, or your daughter feel?
Your chief development officer, Ted Bunch, has consulted on Hollywood scripts. What kinds of reshaping of those scripts and those ideas around manhood and womanhood does he offer to writers and production companies?
The media and what we watch and what we listen to has a huge role of shaping our perception of things. And Ted goes in and just really looks with a third eye, I should say, and really can share the impact of how it would really impact someone, and just offer ideas of how that can be changed in order so it does not degrade someone or does not oppress someone. And I think we have to think about those intersections of oppression at times. And so he's able, by doing this work so long, that he's able to see that and he can offer. And I think he does a lot of work with SVU as well, Law and Order SVU too.
The Washington Post published a piece about Vice President Mike Pence and this rule that he has, which he attributes to the late Billy Graham. He will not eat alone with a woman or meet a woman alone other than his wife. Now, a lot of people would say that's a pretty great rule for making sure that you maintain appropriate boundaries with other women when you're married. Would you agree with that rule? Why or why not?
Well, I really try to stay away from, you know, individual rules. I just really try to really focus on how we conduct ourselves as men, you know, and what's that our behavior, but not only our behavior, but the atmosphere that we're creating for everyone, you know, within our environment. And it is a good atmosphere. Is it something that we can feel good about, that we're passing on to the next generation, that we're not only that we're creating a positive atmosphere that no one feels oppressive around us. And so I really can't get into his personal rule.
Sure.
But I just really think when we continue to have this conversation around healthy manhood, how do we coexist in society that's respectful?
Is part of it developing healthy relationships with females?
I think the part of it is really respect is the key word. And respect of females, respect of other males. And I think that would really eradicate a lot of the oppressiveness that we see in society as a whole.
You have traveled around the world conducting trainings for men about this. And you've been to Japan, West Africa. What are some of the cultural differences there that contribute to the same issue of domestic violence or sexual violence in some of these other countries where the culture on the surface appears to be very different?
And that's a great question, because as I've traveled and I've seen many different cultures, but there was a question I was asked while I was in West Africa and said, do you have this violence in your country? And I said, yes. And what we've seen is, even though culturally we are different. But when we look at our male socialization, it's so much the same, because the problems that that they're dealing with there, oftentimes worldwide, we're dealing with 1 in 3 in domestic violence when it's 1 in 4 here. But we're dealing with it. I mean, there's still a high volume there. It's still a high volume here. So that's why it's important that we continue to have this conversation about how we have been socialized as men and how we need to be respectful to society as a whole. That's why it's, and you were thinking it was kind of disappointing in a way that, you know, you go to another country as a consultant for prevention to end violence, but you're dealing with the same thing here, and that there's much work to be done here as well.
You're listening to Coastline. Ricky Houston is reverend at Pilgrim Rest Missionary Baptist Church. He's also a prevention specialist for Wilmington Domestic Violence Shelter and Services, and he's the lead trainer for the national organization A Call to Men, the Next Generation of Manhood, which leads trainings for professional athletes, university students, military, and corporations. Today's edition of Coastline is pre-recorded. Most of the trainers with A Call to Men are men, but there are some women, 3, I think. What's the difference in the gender of the trainers, and is that a factor in terms of where they go and the kinds of trainings they conduct?
One of the things we do, normally when we're professional athletes, we walk in and we have a conversation with men. But when we're doing institutes and other different trainings, we have a mixed audience. We make sure that we have women trainers so we can engage our audience in different ways. And one thing at A Call to Men, we always want to make sure that the voices of women are heard. But the next thing is that there are often trainers that we go to that, you know, you have a 50-50 split in the room where there are as many women as there are men, because when we're having this conversation, when we look at moms, and I've had single moms say, hey, I was glad I came to this training, because when we talk about around healthy manhood, said, I'm guilty of raising my son in that box, that man box. And so it was great for me to hear this message so that I can really look at how we've been taught them to view women, so that we can make sure they're very respectful of women. So, but we do have a diverse training group. Actually, we have 5 women on staff now, trainers. Yeah.
So you talked earlier about how when you break apart the man box, you're also breaking apart the woman box. So if just a few minutes left, if you were to leave someone today who wants to know, like, what is one really effective step that I can take so I can be part of this movement, moving the ball down the field on this issue, what do I need to be thinking about? How can I start to do this?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that challenging people to be their authentic selves, and not try to fit in some box that society has created for you.
How do I know if it's society's box or my authentic self?
One of the things that we have done is that my son is a senior at Boston University, and I love their slogan. It said, at BU, be you. And I think that's the biggest thing is to be yourself. Choose things that are right for you. Because when I think about the man box, even in relationships, we think about men, about being in power and in control. If you break up with someone, hey, they're more fish in the sea. But we have a totally different box than our young women. So we can encourage them to be who you are, be your best self, but also encourage our young boys to be your best self. Don't worry about the box that society has created for you.
And feel your feelings.
Exactly. Feel your feelings. Thank you.
That's this edition of Coastline. Ricky Houston, what a pleasure having you with us today.
It's been great being here with you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.